Alexander Mariotti is an award-winning Roman historical consultant and a leading speaker on gladiatorial life, combat, and weaponry. Following academic work, his main focus has been working as a historical consultant and advisor to the media, featuring in countless documentaries, TV shows, and movies, most recently for the Amazon Prime TV show, Those About to Die, with Sir Anthony Hopkins himself. Alexander, welcome to the show.
Zaza, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
I was really looking forward to this conversation, to be honest. I am a massive fan of Gladiators. We're going to talk about it later on. But I wanted to ask the following first. Now, I'm sure that your job is outrageously fun. I can feel my jealousy dripping from the very sentence I just uttered. But is it also a tiny bit frustrating because you're graciously giving away all of this awesome knowledge that you have, trying to make everything look more authentic, in other words, better? But then the director is just like, I'm sorry, Alexander, but the shot is going to look much more epic if, I don't know, Spartacus stabs the gladiator in the crotch or something.
Yeah, well, the joke I always say is that I'm actually paid to be ignored. But it's not as glamorous as it sounds. For me, it is an incredibly rewarding thing to work on films for a simple reason. Historians spend a long time reading books and formulating ideas of what things should look like, but it's purely imagination. And I remember many years ago being at a lecture where, you know, the lecturer was giving this great description, and I was thinking to myself, he's talking about things he's never seen. How's he so sure? And so I ended up working on a couple of shows. I worked on the HBO series Rome, and what I found was that I actually got the opposite. I got to see these things in person. I got to see the massive sets of Rome rebuilt. I got to see the Roman soldiers. I got to see people dressed as gladiators fighting. And it was interesting to note what the imagination caught, what the eye caught, what the mind remembered. And these things certainly have helped me in being able to try and bring that world to life. So for me, that's the side. That's why I do it. That's why I enjoy it so much. And on the other side, it's not really frustrating because I don't see film and television as a means of historical descriptions. I see them really in the same vein as the games of the Colosseum. They're not meant to be accurate. They are an entertainment. They're an imaginative version of events. When people sat in the Colosseum, I really see it the same way as when we sit in the cinema. We sit in our seats. We have an experience which we don't actually physically experience. We visually, we mentally experience it. In the same way that those who sat in the Colosseum did not really, you know, they weren't the ones fighting the animals. They weren't the ones fighting each other with weapons. But they were, in a way. They were visually and imaginatively doing so. So for me, film and television is just the modern version of gladiator games. And that's why I don't go there trying to make it historical. I do try and put as much history as possible. I think actually that the truth is far more interesting than fiction. I don't actually think there's a necessity. But I also understand that the film and TV industry is not a academic industry. It is an entertainment industry.
I see your point, but surely sometimes you must go like, I wish they did it this way, because like you said, it sort of, yeah, like some sort of a historian's itch. It would just be better if it was more authentic, right?
Well, I've walked off shows because of it. I've walked off shows, but
really?
Because, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I worked off a show called Domina. I walked off it because I had a disagreement, which I didn't. At that point, the problem was that there's a lot of negative stereotypes which are reinforced historically, and I felt that they were being intellectually dishonest on purpose. So there I walked off. But that happens. But it's very rare it happens. I've actually walked off a couple of things. Not walked off in like a tantrum. I just said, you know, thanks very much. I have other obligations, and kind of terminated it there. You know, I worked on I shouldn't really mention the names of things, but I walked off something where someone was trying to tell me, because the costumes were made out of denim. Oh yeah, denim's historical. It's not. It's not historical. I can tell you for a fact it isn't. You know, especially when we talk about a time period. But yeah, you know, it sometimes it is a little frustrating, because I think there's no need sometimes to make things up. I think history is fascinating in itself. And you could actually use things that are historically accurate and still wow crowds. In fact, I think you might get more of a wow factor because people say, oh, this never happened. And then they'll look it up and go, oh, it did. Wow, that's amazing. A good example is in the first Gladiator, they were going to have Russell Crowe coming out the Colosseum as the General Maximus or as the Gladiator. And he was going to be advertising olive oil. And they thought, no, that's ridiculous. No one's ever going to believe that's true. Whereas the fact is that gladiators actually did advertise products when they went to their fights. So it's funny that they thought the modern audience would never accept something of that caliber, when in fact it's absolutely true.
Now that you mentioned it, in the context of that film that I'm a massive fan of, imagining Russell Crowe suddenly advertising olive oil would throw me off a little bit. I have to say, probably. Okay, so now I understand. There has to be like a dramatic, it has to make dramatic sense within the context of the genre and the film and the story. You can't just authenticity and then like advertise olive oil and it's going to be a funny little scene that sticks out like a sore thumb.
Well, put it this way. You know, the whole premise of Those About to Die is the title. Because it's so dramatic, it just really grabs your attention. Those about to die salute you. We all know this phrase. It's not an actual phrase that's attached to gladiators. It really doesn't have very much to do with gladiators at all. And the truth about gladiators is that if it was accurate, it would be those who rarely die salute you. But that wouldn't make a great title of a film. You know, if that was the name of the series, Those Who Rarely Die, you're like, oh, I don't know if I'm
that bothered. A bit underwhelming, kind of yeah.
Yeah, I hope someone does die. Maybe they, you know, how exciting is that going to be, you know? But yeah, the truth sometimes isn't as dramatic as directors want them to be. And that's okay because film people are film people. They're not history people.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Fascinating. That's why I love talking to historians, because the truth is more more fun. It's more fun if it's authentic, and it's more fun if it's more complicated and more nuanced.
It's more relatable.
Yeah.
You know, 100%. If we take, I mean, that's my thing with gladiators is that I always try and get to the human side of it and try and make people understand we aren't talking about superhumans. We're talking about people. And when you talk about people, then you understand that you and I could be gladiators. We are part of that experience. We're not detached from it. There's a certain attitude when people go to the Colosseum to feel detached from it. Like the Colosseum, some sort of alien structure, is from a different time period. We can't understand it. You know, we're so much more moral and noble. And the truth is, we're not. We are the Romans. We're very much Romans. And had we existed in that time, we would either have taken the chance to be someone in the arena or definitely to be the ones watching from the spectator stands of the arena. So when you get to the human side, you start to relate more to it. You know, when you take away the myth that gladiators were guys who, you know, fought for hours on end, and you're like, no, because the body's a machine and we're using the same machine that our ancestors were. So when you get in a fight after about 5 minutes, and it doesn't matter if you're like the champion, most, you know, greatest athlete of the UFC, you see these guys after a round or two, they're gassed. So why do we look at that and then look at gladiator movies and go, oh, yeah, these guys had swords and they're swinging? And no, they fought in rounds and they had referees because they were humans, they were people, and they had limitations. So you got to get through the myth to get to the person. And when you get to the person, then it becomes more relatable and you go, oh, this is my history. It's about us.
Okay, let's start to go through the myth. Something I always wondered was, why was it the Romans specifically, as opposed to any other ancient culture in the region, let's say, like, I don't know, the Egyptians, the Persians, or the Greeks, who developed this sport?
It's a good question. You know, it certainly is, I think, the size and scale of the Roman Empire and the nature of the Roman Empire that led to gladiator sport being the sport. But its origins, you know, its origins are a little bit shrouded in mystery because we have sort of two versions of where the gladiator came from. And I actually do attribute it to the Greeks. I think, well, first of all, I think that there's elements of gladiatorial combat which are intrinsically sewn into our DNA. I mean, there's just, you know, the idea of combat, of superiority of combat, that's always going to be part of us. And you see it prevalent in our sports, in our culture, in our entertainment still today. And you've seen it throughout history. So I would argue that there's elements of gladiatorial combat that have been with us since the beginning of time. But as a sport, you really see it with the Greeks. And the Iliad, Homer gives us a great scene in the Iliad in book 23, which is the funeral of Patroclus. Patroclus is Achilles' friend. He's killed by Hector, prince of Troy. And Achilles puts on a show. So the show has three elements which have to do with gladiatorial combat. The first is the funerary element. So because it's a funeral, he puts on games. The second is the entertainment element. So he gets all his prize champions, Greek champions, to fight for prizes. So they're not fighting to the death. They're putting on exhibitions of bravery, of skill, of martial skill to honor the dead. But at the same time, they're not killing each other. And then there's sacrifice, because then Achilles sacrifices 12 Trojans. So in one scene, you've got the three rudimentary elements of gladiatorial combat. So that's the seed. And of course, the Greeks conquered most of southern Italy. In fact, it was known as Magna Graecia, Great Greece. So it's prevalent in Italy. And when the Romans start conquering, as they did, and taking over these settlements, they inherit a lot of Greek culture. And that's where the sort of, let's say, the beginning of gladiatorial combat really comes from. It's in Italy already, but it's brought by the Greeks. It's just that the Romans take it to another level, because they introduce it, first of all, as funerary games, but then you have the right environment, which is that you have the Roman Republic. You have a period of guys who are becoming excessively wealthy and powerful and political. And what they do is they start using gladiatorial combat, because it has such a draw, to make themselves popular. And what happens is that Rome becomes an empire. So it's really, it's funny how the sport is tied to the rise of the empire and the rise of the emperor. And they're so linked that one needed the other, because the emperor used the games, used the draw and the interest in gladiators as a way to make himself popular. And the gladiator needed the industry, which was supplied by the empire, to become the sport it did and to reach the levels it did. So that's why the Roman gladiator exists as it does, and why its history is so tied to Roman history.
Fascinating. But if we go back to the Greeks for just a second, Roman culture obviously owed a lot to Greek culture, right? And I always imagined, I don't know if that's accurate, but the ancient Greeks is maybe a little bit like the modern French, a stereotype, obviously, but as sort of epitomizing the high culture of the day, being super bougie, looking slightly down on what they perceive to be less sophisticated societies, even if some of those, like the Romans, actually conquered them, right? So do we perhaps know what the Greeks thought of this, for them, probably quite ruffian activity?
The Greeks, well, we do know because they had a philosophy. So the Greeks' philosophy was arete. Arete is personal excellence in what you do. And it actually came to a sort of conflict with Roman philosophy, where the Romans believed in a philosophy which I think is a very important one. It's called virtus. Virtus is mental and physical strength and agility and endurance. And I think that virtus is, again, a very DNA. It's in our DNA, because you see it in our culture. You know, UFC fighting is virtus. It is the appreciation of physical and mental endurance. If you watch two guys in the championship of the UFC, even if the other guy gets beat, but he puts in, he takes the punches, he gets back up again, man, we really admire that. That's virtus. And I think it's funny because I would say in recent years, there's been a real attack on that aspect of culture, of society, sorry. And the more we try and suppress it, the more we create it. You know, superheroes are virtus, like Hercules was to the Romans. He's a superhero. He's more than human, but he's there to remind us to go forward, to get to be better, to endure what life throws at you. And arete and virtus really came to a head, because arete, then what happens is, when the Romans conquer the Greeks are no longer about war. So they become obsessed with personal excellence in sport. And the Romans hated it, because they were all about these bodies. They were all about the physique, about being perfect. They weren't actually functional, but they wanted to look like the statues. Originally, the statues were made
aesthetics.
Aesthetics. And I think that if you look at today's gym culture, you have the same problem. you have, like, if you go on Instagram, you've got all these perfect bodies, but they're not functional. You know, they're great to look at, but they don't have any function behind them. And that's exactly what the Greeks and Romans had a problem with. The Romans are like, the Greeks are just, you know, they're obsessed with their looks and their diets, and they're not really tough. They don't have the virtus that the Romans do.
Wow, that is, what a superb analogy. So, like, Greeks in contemporary terms, gym culture, Romans, UFC.
It's functionality
versus aesthetics.
Functionality versus aesthetics. You know, anyone who goes to the gym or who's becoming an old man like me and goes on Instagram and sees all these, like, these poses, you know, and then you're like, you can't actually run. You know, you look at these great bodybuilders, you can't run, you couldn't probably fight. And I feel very Roman when I do that. And I think, okay, well, that's what the Romans were experiencing. So, and I'm sure many people can relate to that.
Amen. Okay, slight pushback one last time on account of the ancient Greeks. So they did enjoy, famously, of course, watching sports, including fighting, like Pankration and wrestling, as part of the Olympic Games. So,
yes.
So what would you say was the crucial difference then there between these sports and gladiatorial combat?
So gladiator sports is the Greeks call these the heavy sports. And gladiator sports is an extension of that. You know, it's kind of like, okay, we can get two guys boxing each other. Great. Now, okay, let's go one further. What can we do? What about if they could wrestle each other? Okay. What about if they could punch and kick each other? Okay, then you got Pankration. It's like, well, how do we go further? What if we added weapons? Okay, perfect. So really, it's an extension. But the mentality that the Greeks originally had towards their sports is inherited by gladiators, because majoritively gladiators didn't die. But there was always the risk of death. The gladiator did not walk into the arena thinking, oh, I'm going to avoid death completely. The gladiator walked in knowing that death might be waiting for them. But they took it with courage. They laughed at it. Anyone who did Pankration, who wrestled, who boxed, faced the same mentality. Because when you boxed, it wasn't in rounds. You went till you were incapacitated. Many of the injuries you would receive in boxing, in Pankration, I mean, they were life-threatening, life-changing injuries. You know, you're talking about two guys going at each other.
There were no rounds, so somebody had to get knocked out, at least.
No, you won. The only way the fight stopped was if you put one finger up, which is what the gladiators later... In fact, you see that there's elements of the sports that are then inherited into gladiator combat. So in gladiator combat, when you were done, you did the missio, you put a finger up. Which, by the way, I always think is so funny that if you go to modern sports stadiums, there's people with foam hands that have the same finger. You know the big foam finger in American sports stadiums?
Yeah, the glove.
Yeah, and that symbol is a Roman and Greek symbol. So in boxing, you put your finger up if you're like, you know, maybe you got smashed in the face and you're like, no, that's me done. Or you were incapacitated. That's when the fight stopped. So there are no rounds. You imagine two guys, they've got leather or wood or metal in their gloves. They are clocking each other. In fact, there's a famous statue called the Boxer at Rest. It's a beautiful bronze statue in a museum in Rome. And you see the guy and he's kind of resting. And you can see his face is smashed. His nose is smashed. His ears are cauliflowered. His lips, you know, cut.
Jesus.
And you understand. Yeah. In fact, there's a very famous inscription from Greece that says a boxer's victory is earned in blood. So the violence of sport is definitely prevalent in Greek sports. Of course it is. But the difference between the Greeks and the Romans, and I always say that the Roman gladiator was the first modern sports superstar. And people always get upset. In fact, if you go on Instagram right now, you'll see there's a couple of videos of me saying it. And everyone's always like, what about the Olympics? The Olympics did not reach the reach that modern sports stars do today. If you look at modern sports stars, the reach they have, the wealth they have, the draw they have is unparalleled in history, unless you're talking about the Roman gladiator. The Olympians didn't come close to the fame or the scale or the wealth that the Roman gladiator did. So I'm not saying, obviously, the Olympians were the first sports stars or first sportsmen, but the first sports superstars that are relatable to modern superstars are the Roman gladiator. They experienced fame on a level. I mean, the Roman Empire is 60 million people. And if you are a good gladiator, you will be the draw. People don't go to the Olympics or never went to the Olympics to see a particular athlete. Romans would go to a match to see a gladiator. And we know this because there are posters in Pompeii that say, you know, come to the games. Fiamma will be appearing. You're like, oh my God. And if you go to a poster and it says, come to the UFC because Conor McGregor's fighting, you're like, oh yeah, yeah, definitely. I'm going to go to that. So that's the difference. The Greeks did not do it on the level the Romans did.
So one of the most persistent myths is that all gladiators were basically slaves, either acquired as prisoners of war or simply sold to gladiator schools. Is that view generally true?
No. There's a great misunderstanding with gladiators, which is that a lot of things that have nothing to do, but are sort of tied into the games are lumped together. So for example, when you went to a gladiator's a game or a spectacle, what you would see is you would see hunters fighting animals. You'd find criminals called Noxii who were condemned to death. And that could be by fighting animals, by fighting each other with weapons. And then you've got gladiators. And later on, Christian historians kind of lump these things together. So what we get is the image of the gladiator that we are accustomed to, which is the poor slave thrown into the arena, fights animals to the death. And that myth has perpetuated itself through modern culture, through film, through television, through theater even. That's not true. Gladiators did not fight animals because beast hunting was an entirely different sport. Criminals did not get any training and were condemned to death. They were not gladiators. And gladiators fought each other, and very rarely, if ever, to the death. It's a real rarity. In fact, we know that they used, for example, blunted weapons. We know this because there's inscriptions. There's one, for example, from an emperor called Alexander Severus, who says to this guy, I give you permission. He's giving permission to use sharp weapons, because that was way more exciting, but way more dangerous, and above all, way more costly, because these guys were athletes, professional athletes that are paid, that are trained, that are fed, that are clothed, that are housed. There's such a cost involved. That cost does not apply to criminals. So condemned criminals would fight each other, yes. And you said it right, prisoners of war. Well, what is a prisoner of war? You are an empire, you're fighting against a tribe, you capture a couple thousand guys. What do you do with them? You know, we're talking about a society that values slavery. So what you're talking about in terms of human cost is a commodity. You've got 1,000 men, you can put them to work, but you can't because the Romans have a history of slaves rebelling. And the most famous is the story of Spartacus. So you have to kind of weigh your odds there and say, if we keep 1,000 fighting men in prime condition who speak the same language in our city, there's a risk they're going to turn against us. So one of the things they did was they used them to their advantage as an example. Fight against the empire, disrupt the peace, you will find yourself in the arena with weapons fighting against your own people. So they would make them fight to the death. They're not gladiators. Gladiators by 75 BC are half slaves and half free men. So it was open to pretty much everybody. There were slave gladiators, of course they were, but we forget the most fundamental thing. To be a gladiator, you had to have the physical attributes. It's like saying, you know, if today you could just grab anybody and make them a boxer, you know, you could just pick anybody you wanted and force them to be a boxer. No, they had to have the physical attributes to be it. So even slaves, you had to be physically right. It wasn't like they just picked some guy off the street and went, oh, he's a slave, throw him. No, you had to have the physical attributes to be a gladiator.
Okay, you just said you had to have the physical attributes to be the gladiator. Could you talk a little bit about the process of scouting potential gladiators? What did that look like? I'm a big NBA fan, for example, and there you have professional scouts sent out to every corner of the planet, investigating talents, writing scouting reports, hoping to stumble upon the next Michael Jordan. Was it sort of similar to that?
Yeah, we have it. We have inscriptions of the most famous gladiatorial agent in Pompeii who goes and scouts. He has scouts, and you know, the scouts will go and they'll say, hey, listen, you know, the decline of gladiatorial combat came because the money got taken out of the sport. When there was the money in the sport, it was like every sport today, like every big sport, right? First of all, it's monopolized. So you have the NBA. So you and I can't put on basketball games, unfortunately. You know, back then, the NBA was the emperor. The emperor says, no, I'm the only one who puts on gladiator games. So all the best gladiators are reserved for me. And you had talent scouts and agents who would go around, and then they would sell to the teams because they were teams. There was what they were called familias. They were, we say family, but they were gladiator troops, teams. And you go to a guy and say, listen, I've got this, I was just in a slave mine, a salt mine, I don't know, in on the outskirts of the empire. I bought this guy. He's 6'2", which, by the way, was very tall for Roman times. Romans were not particularly tall people. Well, nobody in Europe was particularly tall back then. So, you know, 6 foot, he's big, he's muscular, he's good looking, so he'd make a great retiarius because he's the one who doesn't have the helmet. Or, you know, I got this big stocky guy. So, yeah, it's exactly the same. They would scout out physical exceptions that would make great gladiators, and they would know exactly what to look out for. And equally, you could come and, you know, volunteer yourself, but you had to physically go through a medical. So they do a medical examination, then they look at you physically and say, yeah, you know what? Okay. And you had a sort of rookie contract, which is a 2-year contract in which you were trained, and they see if you've got what it takes. And if you don't, they let you go. And if you do, they sign you to a 5-year contract 2000 years ago.
What was the training regimen like once you did make it into the gladiator school? Do we have any descriptions or particular exercises or routines preserved, maybe?
So we do and we don't. And I know that seems like a strange thing to say, but we've got a great Roman writer called Vegetius, and he writes about military training. And what we do know is that military training, gladiatorial training, are actually linked for most of Roman history. Because in 105 BC, we have a guy called Rutilius Rufus who starts using gladiatorial training. He actually goes to the schools and he says, train my soldiers. Because that shows you that already in 105 BC, these guys are exceptionally well trained. So we know that the military training and gladiatorial training are linked. And through that, we can work out, as Vegetius says, no man either on the battlefield or on the arena has ever been successful without first fighting against the palace. So the palace is a 6-foot like log, like a wooden dummy, and they would strike against it with a weighted weapon, usually a wooden sword called a rudus, which was to build up your muscle. And so they would have done kind of what we do in boxing or UFC. You would have, you know, when you watch those guys training, they do combinations, right? They do combinations, takedowns. That's what it would have been. But we also know, because we inherited this from the Greeks, there's a system called the tetrad, and it is a split training system. It's a four-day routine. So you do 1 day skills, you do 1 day physio, you do 1 day rest, and then you kind of have another day where you focus on like specific skills, and then you restart again. So the training would have been very intense, but part of the training would have been when to stop. Because if you think about, again, when you think about UFC, when those guys are knocking each other out, right, they have to often be pulled off each other because you're in a fight or flight situation. Your adrenaline's kicking in. It doesn't matter how good you are, how much training you have. When you get in a ring and there's people chanting your name and they're booing and they're shouting and you're getting punched in the face, you don't reason. The fight isn't about reasoning. It's about your mental strength, because it's the ability to control the body, to do the right moves. Gladiatorial combat was the same, but it was even more so because you had weapons. So the point of the training wasn't to kill. It was to put on a show and to stop when the referee told you to stop, because there's two referees. Or most importantly, when the editor, who was usually the emperor, the guy who put on the games, told you to stop, because they decide who wins and who loses, not you. So very intense training, very... And so much so that the military starts using their training.
You partially answered this question already, but did gladiators as a rule had to look good and be kind of ripped? Or could a successful gladiator, if he was a showman, also be a bit chubby and you know, potentially as ugly as a gargoyle if he was wearing a helmet, yeah, let's say.
We have a very beautiful mosaic in a place called Galleria Borghese, which is in Rome. And you see all types of bodies. You see from, because you had different disciplines. The gladiators were mixed martial artists. Every type of discipline of gladiator had a specific type of fighting that went with it because they had a specific weaponry and specific armor that complemented it. So they didn't fight the same way. They all had different styles. And a bit like, again, like UFC, where you've got like the guy who does grappling and then it's become now where everybody has to be a little bit good at something, right? Gladiators became the same. So they became ambidextrous. They became, one could fight as a retiarius, but then maybe learn another style. So yes, so physically they look different. So like you get a Murmillo, he was wearing very heavy armor. So he would usually be like the big stocky guy, like the big sort of heavyweight looking guy. Then you get like the Thracian, he'd be a little slender, he'd be quite muscular because he's all about speed and agility versus the Murmillo that's all about power. Like you're whacking against him. He's got a big shield, big helmet. So yeah, and of course it had a draw also for aesthetics. You know, we see this in our sports today. You get some fighters that are technically brilliant, but man, they're boring to watch. But then you get the showman, the person who gives you the show, who entertains the crowd. He might not even be the best fighter, but that's the ones we like. And the gladiators knew that it was more about the show than about the fight itself. And that's because the Roman world is based on fighting. People experience fighting. We experience fighting as, you know, as men, we live in the realm of violence. You know, we have to be constantly aware that if we go to a football game or a pub or any sort of social gathering, there's always, especially when you throw in alcohol, the propensity for violence. So we know violence, which is why when we look at our sports, we kind of accept what is good violence in the sense of who's able to actually overcome physically these obstacles, who's really good at fighting. And take that to the ancient world where weaponry fighting was very, very frequent. So they knew what weaponry fighting looked like. The arena wasn't a representation of what a real fight was like, in the same way that movies are not a real representation of any fights, of street fights, of war. They give us an imaginative, entertaining version, and that's what we look for. Same with the Romans.
Okay, what about diet? Do we have any archaeological evidence or written records, for that matter, on how, what were these guys eating? Was it like today, all about like consuming lean protein? Or was it, again, different depending on the class of gladiator?
The thing with gladiators is I don't give a given rule for anything. We are talking about a sport that's 700 years old. You know, you look at our sports, UFC, I think, is like 30, 40 years old. You know, football, American football is what, 200 years old. This is a sport that lasted for 700 years. There was bound to be different periods of different things. There are always theories go around that they were like barley eaters, or they fed them like a lot of like, kind of like sumo wrestlers, like a stew is called pulse, which is, you know, a lot of grains. And, but we found gladiator skeletons and, you know, from the tests they do in them, they seem to have very balanced, normal diets. So it depends where. Think of it this way. Imagine they found skeletons of an NBA player 2,000 years from now in America, and they found one in Italy, you know, from the Italian basketball team. There would be comparative differences physically, you know, but if we only found, basketball players' bones from Italy, we'd say, oh, they weren't actually that tall. We find that they weren't as tall as we think they were. It's so isolated because we are so dependent on archaeological finds, and they aren't as frequent as we think they are. But they would have had varied diets. And, you know, there's some great advice from even Olympians who say when it comes to the games, try and consume less sweets and drink less alcohol. Well, that makes sense. It makes sense because going back, not to repeat myself, the body is a machine and we aren't using a different machine from them. They're using the same ones. So if you do a certain diet, you know the results you're going to get. So it stands to reason that they will have had diets very similar to what we have. A little bit of protein, carbs. They would have worked it out over the course of time.
Wow, they figured out that carbs were problematic already back then.
Well, too many, you couldn't too much certainly, carbs, at least. You couldn't certainly eat bread and look like the statues, could you?
Yeah, I guess that it's not so hard to figure that
out. I'd love to meet somebody who eats bread. You know, I love bread. I'm addicted to it. I'm addicted to carbs. You
know? I know.
But I don't look like the statues. So, you know, I realize that if I want to look like the statue of Hercules, I probably need to change my diet and eat whatever that guy was eating to look that way.
I'm never going to be able to let go of croissants. It's just a fact. Oh, well. I wanted to ask you, what was gladiators' social standing in Roman society? Were they perceived as the lowest of the low, as people usually say?
Yeah, but Roman society is a little Victorian in that case. They don't like people who show themselves off. The Romans are very about modesty. They're actually, it's quite funny because I'm half Scottish. It's very Scottish. We don't like to show off. We're kind of suspicious.
So like self-deprecation is big, kind of.
Yeah. In fact, the Emperor Augustus is the one who puts visors on helmets. The helmets are open before. And this is a really excellent move. First of all, because he kind of adheres to the modesty of the Romans. You're covering the face. So it's not about the person anymore. That person actually melts into a character. And that's what's also clever, because the gladiator helmet is so iconic. And we see this in modern culture. Like if you think about Darth Vader, right, in Star Wars, one of the most sort of iconic bad guys, if he didn't have the faceplate, you know, it wouldn't be as frightening. It wouldn't be as daunting, would it? So we have psychology ingrained in us where when we see something that isn't human, it's almost like a robot or a titan, and gladiators have that same effect. But it also hides the person. So you don't see them, you know, are they in pain? Are they struggling? Are they angry? We don't know. Their face is expressionless. And this adds to the lore of the gladiator. It becomes a little bit like a robot or a machine like the Terminator, you know? It has no human side to it. And the Romans didn't, for example, like nudity. And this is a big difference between Greek athletes. The Greeks loved their athletes to be naked, and the Romans absolutely not. So they were armored and clothed, and then eventually they're just wearing underwear, because to show you how much, by 174 BC, they're just wearing underwear. And the reason was that they realized that if you got a wound or a cut and your tunic went into the wound, it caused infection. So they stripped the guys to their underpants to avoid infection and avoid death. And that's 174 BC. So we already know through history that they're trying to keep these guys alive. They're not just killing them. But the social standing is that you are an infamous, infamia, which is the lowest of the low. And these are deemed like the worst. You have no social, you know, protection. You are like an actor or an undertaker or a pimp. These, for some reason. And again, these are people who first of all, do things that the Romans deem very immoral, but also do things that show themselves off like actors. And the crazy thing is that they don't have a great social status, but they are loved and admired, and they're very contradictory as figures. But I mean, they're part of human society. That's a complex thing. I would say the same of sports stars today. You know, you take like some of the most famous UFC guys, they're not really seen in a very high social status. They're very wealthy. They're at the great parties, but they're not being taken, you know, to political parties to have a discussion about what they think about the world. We don't really care what we're not interested in their intellect. We're interested in their physicality. And gladiators were the same. They were entertainers. They were very popular, but they weren't seen in a very high light, no.
However, there were several emperors who fought in the arena, sort of like gladiators, right? Although I imagine these fights were probably a tiny bit fixed. I presume that whole shtick didn't go down particularly well with the Roman public, did it?
No, but it says a lot about the gladiator. Yes, he has no social status, but then you've got the guy who has every social status, who is the most wealthy, powerful, influential person in the world at that moment, who wants nothing more than to be the gladiator. you know, and you see this, you see this in everybody. Everybody, I meet a lot of very famous people, a lot of celebrities, a lot of politicians. And what's funny about them is they all have one thing in common, which is every one of them wishes they'd done something else or in another life, you know, who, even myself, I would have loved to have been a famous athlete. Gosh, that would be amazing. You know, I played a professional sport until I was 21 and then, I stopped playing, but I always thought about it. And even The Rock, you know, The Rock, who I think is one of the great examples of a real gladiator today, you know, the hype, the name, the size of the guy, the lack of fighting, you know, The Rock is the most famous fighter who's never had a real fight in the world, but he's the toughest guy. You know, that's very gladiatorial. There's a great amount of gladiatorial pageantry in American wrestling. You know, these guys call themselves Flame or Blade, and then you've got the guy who's called The Rock or The Undertaker. And the Rock wanted to be a football star. You know, all these interviews. So you get someone like the Emperor, like Commodus, who's the son of Marcus Aurelius. He's born into the empire. People literally kill each other to become emperor. This guy wants to be a gladiator. And we understand because he grew up, you know, it's like growing up in a political family. It's like being the, think about Prince William. You know, you grow up and you watch football and you're like, man, I just want to be a footballer, but I have to be king. You know, and if you have enough power, maybe he says, you know what, I'm actually just going to play for Manchester United. Would be like, well, you're the king. That's kind of ridiculous. And you see him on pitch playing because he has all the, you know, he has the power to do it. That's what the emperors are doing. Commodus says, I want to be a gladiator. Who's going to stop me? But you're emperor. And they did. And he trained and, you know, they were just exhibition fights. They weren't actual fights. The guy who's the emperor wants to be the guy in the arena. And the arena really is incredible because when you look at the structure of the stadium, you've got the gladiator in the middle of the sand and you've got from the bottom all the way up, you know, you've got the emperor, you've got the imperial family. And as you go up to the top, you've got the poor, right? Which is the same as stadiums today. You know, where you sit in a stadium is how much money you have. It's economic. If you have a lot of money, you can sit right there where the game is at the bottom, great view. And if you don't, you get to the top. But what's incredible is that when you watch the games, it turns upside down. The focus isn't on the emperor or the rich or the poor. It's on the gladiator. And I think after the emperor, the gladiator was the one who could command the attention of thousands. They were the most popular, admired, and worshipped figures of 60 million people.
Silly question while we're on it. Was it possible to see any action at all from the bat seats, from the poor people seats at the Colosseum? I've never been there myself.
Yeah, of course. Colosseum, probably, you know, they estimate between 50 to 85,000. I tend to go towards the 80,000. When you go to the top and you look down, it's kind of like being at a stadium. It's the same, like, you know, it's not great, but you can kind of make out what's going on.
My fascination, like I said before, with gladiators obviously began with Ridley Scott's movie, Gladiator, mm-hmm. which we had on VHS tape in our house. Oh, I still remember the epic
times.
Looking.
Glorious times.
Yeah, amazing times. It was in a golden case that the tape was in. Anyway, in Gladiator, Maximus's beginning as a gladiator, it kind of shows the local fighters that if successful, they would eventually work their way up from some backwater province all the way to the Colosseum. Was that depiction accurate?
Yeah, I mean, it's accurate of sports today. You get guys who come from, you know, some lower leagues, some middle of nowhere, and get picked out by an agent and then signed to a big team. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not true of every gladiator, you know. But some certainly would have made it from the outskirts and made their way up because you want to play in the big leagues. And that's, of course, the Colosseum. But it's also the reverse, which is that after you were done in your career, you could go to the lower leagues. So you see that with football, soccer players, right, where they go and play in like obscure leagues that really, the money's great, but there's no prestige to it. As a gladiator, once you were done, you could either go into training, you could train other gladiators, or you could go and do a stint on the lower provinces, you know, such as you saw in the movie Gladiator, where they go to Morocco.
I keep being kind of gobsmacked at how similar it all is to modern professional sports, not just combat sports, but sports in general. You know, like a lot of players will they once they finish with their careers will then go on to be coaches or managers or assistant managers or scouts or whatever. It sounds so very familiar, everything.
Well, there's a historical context for it, which is that we are more like the Romans than anyone else has been in history. And there's a couple of really important reasons for it. The first is that if you look at the world today, it resembles the Roman world in that you can go anywhere and there's a stadium. You can go to a small town to a big city and there are stadiums. And that's the Roman Empire. You could go to a small backwater province. You could go to the big cities. There was a stadium, there's an arena. But this is a relatively new thing because this has only been, it's the last 200 years have brought us to this moment, because 200 years ago is when they started building the first stadiums again. It's predominantly because in the Victorian era, baseball became quite popular in America, cricket in England, and so they started to build stadiums. And then you get to our moment, which is we're at the culmination. We're like at the golden age of gladiatorial combat, where you've got these vast stadiums, they're packed. There's a ton of money involved. You have all these guys who are making this money, this fame. You don't have that in history when you look back, unless you look at the gladiators and Rome. And again, Greece didn't come close. So we're very similar in that fashion, but we also have something else that the Romans have. We live in cities of millions of people. And throughout history, that's a blip. The fascinating thing is when you look at history as a whole on a timeline, most of human history doesn't look like the way you and I are living. Cities, abundance, sports, amphitheaters. For the last 1,500 years, or actually, sorry, previous to that, the first city to be a million in the world was Rome, and it was also the last for 1,500 years. So when you think about even our surroundings and you look at human history, it doesn't look like that. Romans knew what it was like to be in a city of a million people. No one else did until 200 years ago.
Yeah, that's it. I think it's hard to remember that, you know, because we often think of, or I think of, like human history of being kind of teleological, going towards like progressing slowly, you know, and then you don't it doesn't enter your mind that like for 1,500 years there were no like you know big cities, there were no metropolises anymore. What was it then, the next one? Maybe
They didn't
Paris
have the
in the 19th century or something?
Nope. Victorian London is the first city since Rome to be of a million.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay,
And you know, it's
wow.
crazy is that it goes the same with construction, right? When the Roman Empire collapsed, the ability to build on the scale the Romans did got lost. Things like concrete were basically alien technology. So they could even build stadiums the way the Romans did until we started rediscovering those techniques. And we only put them into use, even though we discovered them in the 1500s, in the 1800s. So really, we're at this wonderful, fantastic golden age of human history. But we're the blip. Most of human history doesn't look like us. The only period comparable is ancient Rome. That's when you go, they were kind of doing it before us, and that's why they are so similar, so many similarities. It isn't coincidence.
If we return to the Colosseum, could you perhaps, through the eyes of, let's say, an average Roman citizen attending the games, describe the typical sort of events of the day for us?
Sure. And well, that's actually somewhere else we resemble the Romans. If you 500 years ago went to the Colosseum, you'd look at it and go, I don't know. I don't know what it was like. What does it sound like for 85,000 people to cheer when they won, or boo when they lose, or that wonderful noise when you're going to the stadium? What's wonderful about the experience of the Colosseum is that it's an experience we share with the Romans, because we know exactly what it was like, because you and I have been to a stadium. And when you get towards the stadium, there's that great noise of people excited, making their way through the stands and stalls. You go up the stairs, as you did in the Colosseum. You come through an entrance onto the seating and into the arena. And then the noise really hits you, as it does when you go to any stadium today, because you've entered in and the echo of the acoustics of the amphitheater. So we know that noise. You would sit down with your friends. You'd have some drinks. You'd go to the bathroom because there was toilets in the Colosseum. They would put awnings over the top to protect you from the sun, same as today. And then you would have the announcer telling you why you were there. And you would have, as you do when you go to the football game or to the NBA, right? You have the announcer telling you. You'd have music playing. So you actually had an orchestra playing or a band playing music. Because the interesting thing about the Gladiators is they fought to a soundtrack because they had music playing that would play with the game. So, for example, when you're there and the emperor comes out, how exciting. Just as when you are sitting in the stadium and you see on the big screen, there's the president. He's come to say hi. Oh, wow, look, there's the president, or there's the head of FIFA or some nonsense, right? And as you sat down, there was a parade. So the parade was music's playing and the announcer would call and out would come the beasts. Because you'd never see them otherwise. Where would you see a lion in Rome? So you got to see the world brought to Rome, lions, tigers. The hunters were called out there. The guys are going to be fighting, and they'd go in a round. You'd have the criminals that would be condemned walking around, and then you'd have the superstars. You know, the music start playing. Here he is, 2 times winner, 16 wins, 3 draws, no losses, the people's champion, Blade. Flame, The Rock, whatever the name was, and the guy would come out and the crowd would go wild. You know, we still do this today. But the incredible thing is that underneath the sand of the arena, there were lifts and lift shafts, and there was trapdoors under the sand. So you imagine, while the sand is here and there's the parade going on, underneath they're loading trees in a lift shaft on a lift. Because when the game started and the music was playing, they'd start pulling ropes and trees would pop out of the ground one at a time and transform the arena into a jungle. Now, does it look like a real jungle? No. In the same way that movies don't look real. They're not meant to. It's entertainment. And you're not going to go to India because you're a Roman and it's 3 months of travel, maybe 4. And, you know, I don't want to do that. I'm just going to sit in the Colosseum and watch the games. So you see trees and then a trapdoor would fall. And just like in Gladiator, tigers run out. Except this time they're not chained. And then another trapdoor would fall and a hunter would run out. And you 2,000 years ago, sitting with your friends, comfortably, safely, as we are on our couches or in our stadiums, would watch a guy hunting a tiger in a jungle with music playing. And when he gets close to the tiger, the music starts building and they're fighting and the music builds up. And then he stabs the tiger. The crowd goes wild. Just as we do when we score a goal. And then the trees popped back into the ground. Pew, 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 pew. And you had sand, and it was time for the halftime show. So the halftime show took place between the hottest part of the day, because you can't have athletes out in the heat, because the body's the body. And so maybe you go home, maybe you stay. If you stay, fire eaters, dancers, acrobats, music, and even better, a raffle. They'll actually go around and throw tokens into the stands, keep a hold of them, and later, number 67, oh, that's me. Congratulations, you won a horse, you won a villa. What a great guy the emperor is. You know, why do you need democracy when you've got a guy who takes care of you and gives you free stuff? And that was the point. The games were the emperor's way of buying your attention. And when he had your attention, buying your affection and popularity so that he could become emperor. And if you think it's any different, none of the big sports organizations, FIFA, the NBA, they don't do everything for the love of the sport. They do it for the same exchange. They get your attention. And when they get your attention, they use it for monetary purposes because they sell you something. So whether it's the emperor selling you the fact that he should be in charge, or whether it's a organized sports organization selling you their products so that they can make financial gains out of it, the exchange is the same. Once the halftime show was over and you get towards 4 o'clock, so a more agreeable time, that's when you get the gladiators. And exactly like UFC boxing, you start with the lesser known guys and then you build up slowly to the title fight. That's why we're there, because we're going to see a rematch between Tyson and Holyfield. I sound old. Most people might not even know who that is anymore.
I thought you meant Tyson Fury.
Tyson Fury and Usyk. Yeah, there you go. So that's what we really want to see. Or Tyson Fury against Anthony Joshua. Wow, that's what I'll go and watch the other matches and then I build up. And of course, you know, every time these guys block the shield, the crowd, and every time the other team's guy got knocked, it's, oh, you know, what's wonderful is that the experience is the same experience you will experience in a stadium today. And again, that is something you and I share with those who sat in the Colosseum, and no one else has shared throughout human history in between in a way that's comparable.
Two things came to mind when I was listening to you there. Number one, you should really probably think about becoming a film director yourself, because you brought everything to life in such an amazingly vivid manner. And number two, did we figure out any aspect of modern sports? It seems like the Romans came up with everything, you know, throwing stuff into the, you know, into the arena, building up to the title match. Halftime show. I mean, Jesus Christ, it makes me feel like our civilization has zero originality to it. Can you reassure me?
You know, it's interesting, though. Let me tell you something, though. It is original, and I'll tell you why. Because it wasn't that somebody looked back through history and said, these are great ideas. It happened as it happened with the Romans organically and progressed through evolution. You know, my theory has always been that if you were to start civilization from scratch, you took a couple of people and you gave them a hut, in a forest somewhere, and they grew, you know, as progressed over time into a civilization, that when that civilization started reaching a peak, they start building stadiums. We didn't start building stadiums because in the 1800s, someone said, oh, the Colosseum's great, we should have one of these. We built them out of a necessity because people were popular, were into a sport. The sport was amassing large crowds. You needed a place to house them. And when the first games happened, the stadiums didn't have toilets. As, you know, stadiums in Rome or in ancient Rome didn't have toilets. And then inevitably you're like, hey, people are peeing everywhere and going to the toilet everywhere because people need to go to the bathroom. Maybe we should build toilets. And then you're like, hey, we're not getting a lot of audience. What's happening? Well, it's bloody hot and there's no shade. So what the Romans do, they get ship sails and they start pulling them over and they start inventing like a system that you can crank out ship sails because people get hot. Our first stadiums didn't have awnings when we started building them in the 1800s. And then they're like, hey, people are hot. So every part of it, even like the halftime show, even like the free stuff, it didn't happen because people read history and said, wow, this is a great idea. Let's copy it. It happened because these are ideas that come naturally over time and evolved organically. So there is an originality to it. It's just we're acting the way we're supposed to behave because I don't believe the phrase history repeats itself. I think it's stupid. My version is people repeat themselves. It's more understandable that history is cyclical and aspects of our society are cyclical because we are people. And we aren't any different from people 2,000 years ago, 500, in that we reason the same way. We want to be famous. We love the idea of being appreciated. Some of us do, some of us don't. We want to be loved. We don't mind being hated. All these very natural feelings and emotions are the same ones that people throughout history have experienced. So why does somebody step into a UFC fight when they know they might lose an eye, break a nose, break an arm, get a concussion, die? Well, some do it because when they walk out, people cheer their name. Some do it because they make a ton of money. Some do it because you get all the ladies and the lifestyle. And then you say, why did someone go into a gladiator fight when they knew they might get cut? They knew they might die from injury. They knew they might not wait, you know, make it out. Well, some did it because when you went out, 85,000 people cheered your name. And some did it because you made a ton of money. And some because you got ladies of all the empire desiring you. How natural, how human.
If we go back to originality, I was maybe thinking that it happened because everything sounded so familiar when you were describing it, that it kind of happened like with the construction techniques that you were also mentioning earlier, that maybe during the Renaissance or later on, we kind of rediscovered all of these contents of Roman sports events and simply integrated them because they work. But you think that it just came organically?
No, no.
up with them?
No, it came organically. And the Renaissance really was a rediscovery of Roman philosophy and art and ideals. But sport really, I don't think, took off as much. I think the problem is that there wasn't, you know, let's be honest, the thing about sport is that you need a certain amount of peace and prosperity to make it happen. And I don't think that the Renaissance quite had that in the same way. But likewise, they rediscovered Roman building techniques. So actually, again, when you look at sort of a timeline of human history, the Romans are building things the size of the Colosseum and bigger, right? And then after the Romans, you see along the timeline, there's nobody doing anything like that till the 1500s. And that's when we start to build like them again. If there'd been no interrupted line between us and the Romans, the world would have been probably covered in construction. But we took a pause of about 1,100 years, and then we started building up. And now if you look at how much cities have you know, how much civilization has covered the planet, but it took us about 300 years from the Renaissance to get to that point where we're like at the Victorian level, let's build again on the scale the Romans are building. Why does the Victorian era start to construct so much? Because it's an empire. So it starts going different parts of the world and starts building up. That's what Rome was doing. Rome was building. Rome didn't build Rome. Rome built the world. They built Rome everywhere you went. France, Germany, Spain, North Africa, Scotland. They were building a world. They weren't building a city. Anyway, sorry. You're saying go back to gladiators.
You said when you were describing the typical day at the Colosseum, the typical day of the gladiator games, and when they were presenting fighters coming on, you said, here's, I don't know, what you call it, Shadow or whatever. He has 16 wins, 2 losses, 2 draws or whatever. It made me think, so did gladiators die while fighting at all? So was the actual aim of gladiatorial combat ever to kill, or was it always just to entertain? And they tried to keep these guys alive at all costs.
So actually, when you came in, there was even a board which had your stats on it. So you would have the stats that said, you know, how many wins, how many draws, how many losses. You know, of course, death did happen. I tend to think that deaths happen more frequently because of injury, because, of course, it was a danger. There was a possibility that you might get a cut or get an injury that would kill you. We know... it's quite fascinating, actually. Modern medicine has a great deal of gratitude to a guy called Galen of Pergamum. He was the doctor of Marcus Aurelius. I've heard of him. And he made his experience through working at a gladiator school. So, you know, history tells us there's a guy, a doctor at a gladiator school, and you're like, why is a gladiator at a doctor school? I thought they were supposed to die. So, and what he's telling you is he starts working out how to suture, how to fix tendons and injuries. But he also realizes things like the Greeks believed that the heart was the point of reasoning. And he tells you of a gladiator that's been actually injured in the heart who is lucid until he dies. But they're trying to save his life. So what we know is here's a guy who's been stabbed in the arena but hasn't been murdered in the arena, hasn't been executed. He's been taken out and he's been given medical care. So there are times, yes. Of course, again, we're talking about a sport that's 700 years old. As the sport progressed and the money went out of it, I think it got less regulated. And there were probably more chances of a gladiator dying or fighting. But the most people who fight to the death are noxi, are criminals, are prisoners of war.
But that is a far cry from the gladiators that we see in the movies or TV. They're just being killed left and right as soon as they set their foot in the amphitheater, right?
Well, but that makes great TV, though, doesn't it? That makes great TV.
It does,
you watch, even when you're those about to die, I don't want to give it away, but there's a scene where the guy just starts hacking people. And you're like, well, if life is so worthless and death is so present, then it makes it even more exciting. You're like, man, my favorite character could die at any moment. There's danger. But that's just a construct to create an entertaining narrative. It's, you know, if you take away the element that the gladiators probably didn't die and you watch the TV show, you're not going to be as taken by it. Death has to be present, right? To be threat has to be there, because we're not there. If you're in the arena, it's one thing, but we're not. We're sitting on our couches watching. So there has to be the idea of death, because it scares us.
So you said there were referees actually there. What counted as a win or a loss then, for that matter?
Funny, again, a similarity between modern sports. There was two, the Rudis and the Sumo Rudis. So there's one in the middle and there's one in the sidelines. So you got the guy in the middle. He's the one who's there. He's in the middle of the fight. He stops the fight, stops the rounds. you know, it probably went to disarmament, to point systems. There's the only distinct difference is that there's the judge is somebody else. We don't have judges. The judge is either the emperor or the spectators, because ultimately the emperor doesn't really care who wins or loses. He cares what the audience wants, because he wants their affection. So he's the one who will let you decide, which is problematic, because if the World Cup final went to the audience to decide if that was a goal or not, it's going to go to who's got the bigger voice, right? Who's got the more fans? You'd never do that. Unless, of course, FIFA wants a bigger group of people to be happier with them, then they'll let you decide. But we're not there. We don't live in a dictatorship. So, you know, it's a bit fairer, I'd say, maybe.
Is there a reason to believe that combat was at least sometimes maybe simulated, like WWE style, in order to protect maybe the gladiators and the investment of the owners that they represent?
Well, the armor's there. The armor's theatrical. It's more theatrical than it is functional. I mean, you know, you've got these big helmets. Great. It protects the entire athlete's head. But you've got little eye holes and you can't breathe very well. So they're restrictive. They don't give you great peripheral vision. Some have like a brim that comes about to here. So, you know, the actual armor itself is telling you a lot about the sport. It's not a functional bit of armor. It's quite theatrical. So there's a great sense of theatrics to the armor. You would expect there'd be theatrics to the fighting. There'd probably be moves that you would never use on a battlefield. You know, battlefield fighting in antiquity is not glamorous. You know, the Romans' techniques was basically to build a wall with shields, have a sword pointing out between the wall and stabbing continuously to the neck, to the eyes, to the face, to the organs. You're just basically stabbing. You're hacking people like they're meat. Nobody wants to see that, not in the arena. What you want to see is the big shield, the sword, the helmet, the and I feel that there would have been certainly a level of over the top, maybe even choreography, to get the fight looking the way it does. Because if the fights are quick and boring, no one's going to be excited. We need to get people
right
back.
But would you say, right, but the fights still weren't scripted? That's what I was kind of aiming at.
I mean, not as far as we know. We can hypothesize that the fights were scripted. Why not? The fights not get scripted today? Do you not watch a couple of fights and you go, I don't know if I, you know, that's a bit suspicious. I mean, we see that today with, you know, I don't know how many names you want to, but look at Jake Paul, right? Look at the controversy that surrounds Jake Paul in the boxing. And people are like, oh, that's fake. Oh, they're putting it on. Oh, that's scripted. You know, it's entertainment, right? It's not real combat in the sense that it's all hype and build up and, oh, I'm going to fight Mike Tyson, even though he's 60. And, you know, that isn't pure fighting. It isn't like I'm a great boxer. I'm going to beat the crap out of anybody I meet. If that was the case, then you wouldn't have the press events. And the bit where you guys, you know, the guys stand in front of each other, what's the point of that? So there's a lot of theatrics to our sports. Gladiator combat would have had the same, of course. There would have been moments I'm sure that they would have scripted it. Maybe not quite to the level of American wrestling, but you know, American wrestling shares with gladiator combat one thing. Why do American wrestlers not fight? They could fight. They're big, nasty guys. And the truth is because they are under contract, and if they fight and they actually fight, they would fight 1 to 3 fights a year because they would hurt each other. The reason it's fake is because you're taking away the threat of injury to your athlete so your athlete can keep fighting. Because otherwise The Rock could fight. He's an enormous guy. He's a big muscly guy. I bet he could pummel a few. But if he actually fought, he might rip his shoulder. He might hurt himself. And, you know, he's got guest appearances to make. He's got movies to make. Gladiators are the same. Gladiators have the fight, but then they've got to make the appearances at the political events, at the private parties. They've got to fight again at the big games of the Emperor next week. So if you eliminate the threat of injury, then you've got more longevity to your athlete.
I wonder the following, like in modern combat sports, from Japan to the US, from Pride to famously boxing, organized crime usually has a bit of a hand stuck in somehow. I wondered, was that the case in ancient Rome as well? Now, you said that it was a monopoly of the emperor, but I'm sure because it was such a big industry that some sort of a gray, maybe economy or fixing matches or whatever could have occurred. Do we know anything 100%. About that aspect?
You know, the fight game is a nefarious and seedy underworld. You know, it's not what we see. There's behind it. There's a lot of unhandly behavior, and because you know what? Because ultimately, again, money's involved, and when money's involved, then you're talking huge quantities of money, and you're talking people. That is a combination. That's, you know, two ingredients that are bound to make bad decisions. Why would we think any less of the Romans to do the same? We do them, and we're so modern, and we're so evolved, and we have, you know, dirty betting and constant athletes getting caught doing illegal things, betting against their own teams and fixing it. Yeah, of course there was, 100%.
How much money would these guys make if they were at the top of their game?
Fortunes. Like, you get a signing up bonus is 2,000 sesterces, and that's 900 sesterces is an annual wage for a soldier. So you're making two times the
annual. And was that considered good pay? Like 900 sesterces in ancient Rome, was that considered a good pay?
It's decent. I mean, it's a soldier's wage. So, you know, I would say it's probably your standard average, your basic wage. Yeah. I mean, it's good enough. And obviously you get bonuses and so on. But you're making two times the annual salary of a Roman as a signing up bonus. We know that the Emperor Marcus Aurelius, who's the guy actually kind of starts the beginning of the end of gladiatorial combat, kind of takes the money out of it. He passes laws of how much you can spend on gladiators. And we're talking up to 150,000 sesterces. You know, you're getting guys making 17 times the annual salary of a Roman in one fight. It becomes very evident why people are becoming gladiators, because the money there is lucrative. And if that's what the gladiators are making, man, think what everyone else is making. You know, the thing is, the gladiator world was an industry. There was people who lived off of it. We know of guys who write posters, who make money by making gladiator posters. So they're the guys who go around Pompeii and they make the posters that say the games are going to be on this day, held by this guy, this many fighters. You've got the guys making the souvenirs. You've got the agents. You've got the trainers. You've got the scouts. You've got the event organizers. It is a massive industry. That's why I say the gladiatorial combat and gladiators are the first sports superstars, the first modern sports superstars, because the business that surrounded them isn't the business that exists in the Olympics. It's the business that exists today around athletes. And who knows where it's going to go, because that's what happened, is there was too much money involved and it became unsustainable. And I think that that's where we're going with our sports. Look in the last 50 years, the difference, you like NBA, of what a player earns and used to earn. Where the heck is that going to go? Football stars, football
LeBron stars. James is a billionaire.
Right, but then if that's because they make the money. If they don't make that money, it's going to get to a point where the teams are going to go, sorry, there's going to be a cap, because now, you know, there's money and people are buying strips and they're going to the stadiums and they're buying subscriptions. It's not a sustainable model. It's going this way. But sooner or later, it's going to plateau, and that's where you're going to see the same changes that happened to gladiatorial combat, and then the sport's going to go down. Of course it will. It's human.
You said that Marcus Aurelius started taking money out of the sport. Why was he doing that? Did he deem it sort of immoral?
Well, he wasn't a big fan of it. He actually loved wrestling. He didn't really care much for gladiatorial combat. Wasn't big into the sport. I mean, he had to go to the games because he was kind of obliged to make an appearance. But when he was there, he would do politics. He would do, he'd read philosophy. He'd practice speeches. Why he did it was because the whole thing about monopolizing came to bite the emperor in the ass, basically. Because you have
to... Because they had to spend so much money.
Right. And so you have a thing called the imperial cult, which is a religion that basically promotes the image of the emperor. So the emperor around the empire would put on games for you. You know, the emperor doesn't make his way all the way to Egypt, but it doesn't matter because the high priest of the imperial cult is going to put on games. The thing is that this was a position that you basically applied for, but it was of your money that you had to put on these games. You got a bit of budget, but you also had to finance it. And these guys were becoming bankrupt trying to put on the games. So he does it to help them out in a way. But he also, because the treasury was involved with gladiatorial combat, and he thought that they shouldn't be. And it's called the fiscus. And he says, what need does the fiscus have of the arena? So before, he was making taxes on the games. It double helps him because it improves his image, but he's also making money from it. He thinks it should have nothing to do with it. So he separates them and he puts caps on how much games can cost, how much you can pay for gladiators. He basically regulates it because there's too much money involved. And by the way, this is going to happen again to our sports sooner or later because FIFA, right? FIFA or the NBA, they're the only ones who can put on these events, right? So what happens when it costs them, you know, 15 billion to make and they only make 14 billion? It's not going to last. They're going to start saying, well, players can only get this much. Teams can only spend this much. Same thing.
So his right. So his reasoning had more to do with the empire's wallet and less with ideological reasons.
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't think it helped that he didn't really care much for the games, but yes, it was essentially it's all about economy. And also they'd gone through a crisis. They'd gone through a crisis. They had basically a financial crisis because they'd had an epidemic. A pandemic, actually, but they had a plague called the Antonine Plague. They had various wars, so the treasury was in bad state. And then it's like, hey, the World Cup's coming up, and we got to fork out, you know, however billions. They're like, no, I don't think so. I think maybe we'll.
Still slightly ironic that Marcus Aurelius wanted to put gladiators, the shows, out of business, and then his son Commodus was like, sorry, pops, I'm going to be a gladiator myself.
Yeah, and pay himself $1 million sesterce for appearances.
Oh, really? Oh, that's a nice reward.
Out of the treasury, yeah. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, that he's the first guy to break his father's laws, just his own son. But, you know, can we not forgive him? I mean, at the end of the day, I don't think Marcus Aurelius didn't know his son wasn't fit to be emperor. But he's a father, and he loved his son, and unfortunately, it costs the world and society a great deal in the Roman Empire. But, you know, we idolize Marcus because he's so wise and so philosophical, but he's also so human. He loved his son and he did what he could for his son. And who can't understand that? You know, it's very understandable.
How does that line go in The Gladiator? Your failures as a son are my failures as a father.
Yeah. Yeah, very true. Very true.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You never said that, but it's a sentiment.
Yeah, yeah. You said that the gladiators were kind of like the most desired men in the empire, a bunch of sexy lads, right? Yeah, do we have any sort of lusty or slanderous graffiti preserved about them in that respect?
Tons. Tons. We have gladiators themselves telling you. There's Calatus the Thracian who calls himself Suspirium Puellum, he's the heartthrob of the ladies. Then you have the trident, the Retiarius, who's the net catcher of ladies at night. But you also have inscriptions of guys writing about noble women who rent prima rationis. So they are the high end gladiators who she rents them out. But gladiators are present not just in graffiti, but they're present in erotic art. There's tons of sort of images of is a wind chime that I have actually have a cast of, where the gladiator is, he's got a sword in one hand and his underwear in the other, and his phallus is a raging dog fighting him. So there's like this obscene art. But of course they were. They were, you know, they're the most exciting guys. They're the guys that 85,000 people admire. They're the guys who fight for a living. They're muscular. They're handsome. They don't even have to be handsome. We have an inscription of a story of a lady called Eppia, who was married to a senator of Rome, very wealthy, grew up in wealth. She falls in love with Sergius, who's described as having his nose as kind of rubbed his ears. He's actually a retired gladiator because he's injured his shoulder. And she gives up her life to follow him and live in the ludus because he's a gladiator. And Juvenal writes, they love the steel. I love that line. I think it's so good. It's the steel they love. So of course, you know, and who are the most sexually desired, you know, men of our society? They're sports stars. They're athletes. Because they are the embodiment of virtus. They are mental and physical agility, endurance, and perfection. They're, you know, they're not humans. They're more than humans. They're heroes, superheroes, Hercules.
They love the steel. I see what he did there.
They love the yeah.
Here's an interesting one. Did female gladiators exist?
Oh, this always gets me in trouble. No. I mean, no, okay. In the sense
let's
that
let's get you in some trouble. Yeah. Oh, they didn't exist professionally.
No, they didn't. In the same way that, you know, they did exhibit women fighting. They weren't professional gladiators, and it's made very clear they're not given training. The discussion for the existence of female gladiators is based on four bits of archaeological evidence, of which they're all arguable. All the bits of evidence, there's nothing that's like a smoking gun. You're like, it's never been found yet. I mean, out of all the finds of the Roman Empire, four bits, and one is like a tomb, and they found some stuff that had to do with gladiators in it. They're like, well, it must have been a gladiator. It could have been a gladiator's wife. It could have been a fan of the gladiators. It could be 100 things, but we're like, yeah, it must have been a female gladiator. There's no evidence for it. The second one is a piece of like an amulet that mentions a Ludia. And Ludia, in fact, the word gladiatrix, by the way, doesn't exist in classical Latin. It's not a Roman term. So the Romans never used that word. It's found in a commentary on the Satires written by Juvenal. It's not a classical Latin word. The Romans didn't have. They had Ludia, which can mean somebody who has to do with the games, who works maybe at the games or is involved in some reason. We do have laws being passed of where women are banned from being involved in the games. We have examples of women fighting, but it's a novelty. It's not something that's done frequently, and there certainly wasn't an industry behind it. I mean, you know, it comes down to money, you know, and it's when you take a sport like gladiatorial combat, it was made for male consumption. I mean, whether it's ancient Greece, whether it's Persia, whether it's Egypt, the point of combat sports was to encourage men to be tough, to inspire them to be physically more prepared. And you know, we have a great quote that says, it does the warrior people good to see the carnage. It hardens them to battle. So that was the point of it, because men ultimately were going to go to war. And it's the same with combat sports today. You know, it's made for male consumption. If you look at ticket sales of the UFC, male to female, what are they going to be? I think I read it was 10% to 90%. I would say that's exactly the same interest that they had in gladiatorial combat. And yes, we do have female UFC stars, fighters. We have female UFC boxers. But they don't quite reach the level of male ones, because the point of the sport is the level of violence. Like, if you see two heavyweights, you want to see the guy knock the guy out. You want to see the brutality of it. And it's obvious that the female version of the sport isn't going to have that intensity. And so you take it to gladiatorial combat, it's the same. And plus, you know, there was attitudes in the society towards women fighting or women displaying themselves. But on a whole, female professional gladiators do not exist. I think it's more wishful thinking on behalf of modern society. We like the idea, but it has no roots in history.
Alexander, we're nearing the end of the conversation, so I do have to ask, which film or TV portrayal of gladiators is your favorite and why? Not the one you had most fun at while filming, but actually your favorite when you watch it.
Oh, you can't ask me that. That's I would say that there's different.
I'm afraid I will insist.
There's different shows and different films for different reasons. I think that Gods of the Arena, the Gladiator series, is the best for showing you the life of the gladiator.
They did a really great job.
Okay. Have you not? Spartacus. Yeah, it's great. Oh, yeah. Blood and Sand. It's great. Really great show. Because it really gave you the life of the ludus. And you don't get to see that in films. The life of the ludus was, these guys training, but also like the admiration that went into it, like the sex, because that was a huge draw of it. I mean, sex is a huge draw for all parts of society, but why would it be different to the gladiators? And these guys were over-sexualized, hyper-sexual, hyper-masculine. But it was just great to see the ludus come to life. And that's why, the fight in Gladiator in the Colosseum, man, that's a great, great example, because when else did you see the Colosseum come to life before Gladiator? Before Gladiator, the Colosseum was, that 20% of structure that we see today is all it is. It's 20%. It's a couple of bricks. But to see it come to life, wow. You see two gladiators fighting in the middle with the crowd going wild, with the audience, with the awnings over the top. But I haven't seen all of those about to die yet, I have to admit. So I'm open to, but so far, yes, the series Spartacus for the ludus and the movie Gladiator for the fight between him and Tigris.
I do love the HBO's Rome. That was such a fantastic show. Not a lot of gladiator combat there, but the show itself was.
No, there's only a little bit.
Special.
But I have a secret to tell you.
Please
I'm
do.
In the show.
No way. Which season?
Season 2.
Are you?
I actually have a little
part of the criminal underbelly.
No. So I have a little secret, which is whenever I work in these shows, I always end up somehow in them. Mostly because productions are cheap, and directors will say, "I want someone else in here. Like, I need an extra. We don't have anybody on set," and they'll be like, there's usually somebody doing nothing. And that's usually me. So they'll be like, that guy, get that guy, get him dressed. And just like, I am with Mark Anthony at the Battle of Philippi. So I did a lot of the fights. I'm actually in the fighting. But I also have one line, which is advance. So when you see it, I think Mark Anthony says, this is how history's made or something. And then he does a sign and I give advance. A very young me without a beard. I'm also in Those About to Die, by the way.
Oh, wow. But the best part of HBO's Rome was Mark Anthony to me. I mean, the actor was just fantastic.
Oh, Mark Anthony. Yeah, James Purfoy was brilliant, brilliant, brilliant guy. And I purposely went to see the scenes he was in because I think I'm in another scene. I'm in the scene where they cut up the empire and I volunteered to
the map
because they just wanted
the map.
Yeah. So they wanted, yeah, he grabs my sword at one point to cut the map. So, I volunteered to be in that one because they only had one guy to be a guard. And I said, I'll do it. Because I wanted to watch the scene. So I was there watching the scene. And at one point I was watching Lepidus, Augustus and Mark Anthony cut up the empire. And I was like, suspend reality. This is what it was like. Imagine I travel back through time. That show, honestly, the work on that show helped me immensely in formulating, when you say I describe things vividly, it's because I've got to see them. It's part of imagination, but majoritively it's visual memory that I've gained from working on these shows.
Yeah, I still remember that scene. It's a really cool scene because Mark Antony comes in with a headache and he's all like cranky and he's like, what do you guys want? And
then he just cuts off. It was Posca's wedding, I think, wasn't it?
Posca's wedding.
Posca's wedding. And then, if you watch it, he comes and he grabs my sword because I'm sort of standing there and he grabs my sword out and uses it to cut the Empire. Yeah, it's a great show. It's a pity they didn't do more of it. And sadly, we lost Titus Puller last year. Ray Stevenson passed away, the actor who played Titus Pullo.
I forgot his name, but yeah, they were great. Pullo, and what was the other one again?
Varinus,
that's right. They're mentioned in Caesar's Chronicles, aren't they, these two soldiers?
They are, yeah. The Bella Gallicus.
Yeah.
They are mentioned, yeah.
Anyway, the trailer for Gladiator 2 just dropped.
Yes.
You must have seen it.
Yes.
What do you think of it so far?
Yes. Yeah, good. I mean, again, these things are very important. You know, I have the largest collection of items in the world of props and pieces from films that depict Rome. So I have the largest collection of items in the world from the movie Gladiator. I have the original helmets. I have the tiger's helmet. I have the...
Where do you live
some
again?
Some Russell Crowe's pieces. Ah! I put them on display from time to time, but you know the tiger's helmet, for example, is a piece of history in the history of gladiators, because in this period of history that we're living in, what has perpetuated the myth of gladiators, what has kept the interest in the history of gladiators alive, are these films and TV shows. The Colosseum was free to get into until Gladiator came out. Gladiator 1 was such a success that that's the first time they started charging money to get into the Colosseum, because they didn't before. When I was a boy, my brother and I used to play in the Colosseum. Nobody cared. There were no gates. There were no entrances or fees. So it's wonderful, because whatever the film does, the one thing it's going to do is going to get people interested in history. And that's the point of it. I don't care about the historical accuracy. Because I can watch a documentary or I can pick up a history book if I want historical accuracy. I want the same thing that a Roman wanted when he walked through the Arch of the Colosseum. I want to forget my life for a couple of hours. And that's what we do. We walk into the cinema to see these films in the same way that our ancestors walked into the Colosseum arches. Because for a couple of hours, I want to be Lucius, or I want to be the emperor, or I want to be someone else. And I want to live this exceptionally exciting experience, sitting on a couch comfortably. And then when I walk out of the cinema, in the same way that the spectators walked out of the arena of the Colosseum, I go back to my normal life.
Alexander, what an absolute treat. Thank you so much for taking the time. This was an epic conversation. I really, really enjoyed it. Where can people follow your work? Do you have social media?
Yes, of course. Yeah. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter and all the socials as the Gladiator Historian or the Gladiator Guide, or just by searching my name. But yeah, I have a body of work that's coming out. I've got a couple of documentaries being released soon. I have one called Colosseum, which is on the History Channel, and one on BBC called Pompeii, the New Dig. But yeah, I've got a couple of lecture series and things that I'll be releasing soon. So yeah, absolutely. Very easy to find.
Awesome. I hope we get to do this again. Maybe I also wanted to talk about Spartacus, but it's such a big subject that I think it deserves maybe, a separate podcast.
We can do it in a separate one. Yeah. You know what? Seeing as there's a new season of Spartacus coming out next year, we can definitely pick up on the story of Spartacus.
Fantastic. I'll take your word for it. And I'm not just saying that. I'm from Eastern Europe. We go for it. You know what I mean?
Perfect, perfect.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening. I really, really appreciate it. This podcast has no sponsors, no production team, and no editors. It's just little old me. And as such, I'm at the mercy of you lovely folks watching and listening. So please do subscribe on YouTube. Click that little bell thing or whatever. Follow on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Also, I don't want to sell you a stupid mug that you don't really need. So if you can, and most of all, if you want, please support me on Patreon. And here I have to express my eternal gratitude to my patrons on Patreon, aka the producers of this show. As always, without you, comrades, this show wouldn't exist. You better believe it. So massive thanks to Marin Ferrara, Aljaš, Štrole, Ajda, Mancian, Miha Medved, Medinjo, Goran, Gordan, Lorenzo, Jurečuk, Mila, Carmen, Veronika, and Taichi. Absolute legends. Thanks again.